The countdown to Black Friday deals on Amazon.com are so good, your shopping list will look even better than Chris's picks in the schoolyard pick. Get the best deals on everything you need with our link. RobHasAWebsite.com/Amazon for our friends in Canada. It's RobHasAWebsite.com/AmazonCA. Coming to you live from my apartment, it's Rob Has a Podcast. And now here's the guy who has mason jars full of podcasts buried all over this house. I'm Rob Cisternino. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Rob Has a Podcast. And we are very excited to do our recap episode here for episode number 9 of Survivor Millennials versus Gen X with our very special guest, Spencer Bledsoe. The young lad will be joining me to talk about everything. So very excited to hear from Spencer and get his take on the season. So that's coming up here in just a bit. We've got a bunch of other podcasts already in the books about this episode of Survivor, including our Survivor Know-It-Alls with Sophie Clark. And then this morning, I had the pleasure to talk to the Taylor Stocker on our Exit Interview podcast and asking about everything from that crazy tribal to everything going on in the soap opera surrounding the real life of Taylor Stocker. So you can check that out on robhasawebsite.com. Of course, our voicemail podcast with Megan Z coming up next. Make sure you don't miss any of it. Subscribe to the podcast. Go to robhasawebsite.com/iTunes. All right, everybody. I'm very excited to bring this guest back here to the podcast to talk about our first Survivor episode recap that we've done since only but the third episode of Survivor Worlds Apart. Please welcome back the young lad, two-time Survivor, the great Spencer Bledsoe. Spencer, how are you?
I'm good. Yo, yes. Rob, what's yes. up?
I'm back. My God. Oh my God. This is so exciting.
I can't contain myself.
Yes. All right, Spencer.
I'm going to start doing impressions. You got to start talking now or I'll just make the podcast terrible.
And Mr. Survivor as well, Spencer Bledsoe.
Yeah, I keep my title still?
Yeah.
I'm still going.
I mean, we haven't done another one. I don't know if we'll ever do another one. I guess that, you know, Taylor is probably in the mix.
Oh, got to be. Definitely.
Yeah.
So the belt's in my closet, so.
So he's right. He's right there, right?
Unlikely.
Yeah.
No, why do you say unlikely? Well, I think those beautiful blue eyes, you just look in them and come on.
You melt.
Taylor.
You melt.
Yeah.
All right. Spencer, of course, you have joined the ranks of the podcasters of Survivor as well. Of course, not podcasting about Survivor, but something that actually matters in life. That you are hosting a new podcast called Redeeming Disorder. Could you talk about why you wanted to become a podcaster?
Yeah, well, it's actually got the name wrong. It's called Survivor with All the Fixings, my podcast.
We call it
Survivor ATF because that's the cool way to say it.
Yes,
and it's going to be first of all, Survivor does matter. What you've built, you know, RHAP.
No sucking community. Kneecaps, Spencer.
I can't not. Whatever you're doing, and I actually talk about this on the podcast, like if you're building a Survivor community or a community around this issue, I think there's a lot of value in it in that people are connecting over it and it's something beyond, you know, just the subject matter. So definitely what we want to do is build a community. And the reason it's important to me, the reason I wanted to do it is it's something that's personally affected me, my family, friends of mine, mental illness, mental disorder, and mental health are, I think, very important issues that just aren't really addressed in society as often as they could be. It's something that you don't really talk about as often as actually occurs. And so I think a podcast is a really great way to start breaking down that stigma and get people talking about it.
Yeah, I want to talk about more about that in a little bit. And I know that it's going to be something that's going to help out a lot of people. So I'm looking forward to hearing more about that. But let's talk some millennials and Gen Xers as we've gotten here on the merch, because I've been dying to get your take on everything so far this season. And I really think of you as the preeminent Survivor millennial. Is that too much pressure?
It is a lot of pressure, but I don't know, when Tony Vlacco said it, I think the words kind of went in stone, and I gotta own it.
Did Tony call you a millennial?
He called me a young lad.
Yes.
It's sort of like, he didn't want to use the dirty word. He didn't want to put me in the same category as Mr. Taylor, the Viking. But
does Tony know about millennials?
What does Tony know? I think Tony's one of the millennials, because if you watch his texts, he clearly is up to snuff with how Jeff would define a millennial. He's,
you know,
the
letter U's
are flowing, the LOLs are flowing. So Tony's all over it. I think Tony's an honorary millennial himself.
Wow. Who I had no idea.
Yeah, it's having two kids is making him less a millennial by the day. You could probably speak to that, but Tony's got the youthful spirit.
But I hear that there's a lot of millennials that are having kids these days.
Yeah, the details, the dates, having kids, I don't remember all. I don't know. I'm kind of spacing out on that.
Yes. Yeah. It's hard to remember.
That was a great exit interview you had with Taylor.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. So when you first heard the idea of a millennials versus Gen X season, were you on board? Were you feeling like, okay, this is something I want to do? Or did you feel like that this was just a way for people to kick around millennials some more?
Yeah, I really read it wrong. I thought it was totally a way for people to kick around millennials. I thought it was going to be just like, first, I actually read it wrong on many levels, because I thought it was going to be, the whole narrative was going to be Jeff saying, you know, these millennials like don't get it. And I thought, you know, Survivor's audience, it's a family show. I figured they would really, you know, want to cater to the people watching. And and so like, these millennials don't have a clue. They don't know how to survive. And I feel like it's been the opposite. Jeff is like a millennial cheerleader.
Yes.
He's like the brain, no collar millennial that no one would know.
He's been very pro-millennial, you feel like.
Yes. Well, I feel like he almost even like sees himself as more in line with with the millennials. And it's not only surprised me as far as like being pro-millennial, but also like we're still talking about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we've already merged. Usually it's the theme is like, all right, let's get people in the door. Let's get people watching early on. And then, you know, episode 3 or 4, we're going to swap. We're going to forget this ever happened. Go back to the normal tribe names. But it's still a part of the narrative.
Yeah, you're right. I think when we go back to Survivor Kagyan, which I guess was called Kagyan and not Survivor Brains versus Beauty versus Brawn, by the time we get to the 9th episode, I think that's when LJ goes home. Is that right? It's somewhere along the way there.
Yeah, somewhere around there.
And it's not like Jeff is like, Spencer, so tell me, as a Brains tribe member, is this sort of like what you deal with as a brain, you know, day-to-day?
Yeah.
You know, it
was
sort of dropped by the time you got to the swap. And we're still talking about millennials and Gen Xers.
Right. Yeah. No one was asking LJ, you know, if beauty had its price when you got voted out.
No. No.
And,
so
yeah. I think it also has to do with how you play. I mean, I'm sure they read what's going on. And when you see Taylor like steal all the food and be totally inconsiderate of everyone around him, then maybe you harp on it. Whereas, you know, Tony didn't necessarily win through Braun, and it wasn't necessarily the themes did blur a lot more in that case.
So going back to the tribal council that we saw on Wednesday night, really one of the crazier tribal councils. Of course, Survivor Kagyan has a number of really crazy tribal councils and things happening at tribal. Did that tribal council remind you of any of the tribal councils that you went to, whether it was in Kagyan or Cambodia?
Yeah, actually one tribal council in Kagyan that never made the air, but it was interesting. It kind of reminded me of this time we went to. It was like one of the first merged tribal councils, and we went to tribal council, and Jeremiah of all people decided to really drag LJ through the mud. And
why?
It was like, well, it was because of this conversation he had had with Cass, where Jeremiah said like in a sweet Jeremiah way, like, LJ, why don't you just ask Cass what she thinks of your profession? Because LJ said he was a horse trainer and that was his thing. And Cass started talking about this big theory she had that LJ was a con man.
A con
and
man?
She said she's like, yeah, LJ, I think you're a con man. I think you like came onto this show having like conned everyone in terms of casting and telling them you're something you're not, and that your real profession is that you are like a professional catch me if you can guy.
Wow. I mean, that would be a really bold move then to go on Survivor as like a professional, like con man, right?
I'm still waiting for it. I mean, one of these days, there's going to be a guy with like a solid, it's going to be like Jeremiah out there. And then on Final Tribal Council, he's going to be like, drop out of his Southern accent and be like, my name is actually Frederick. I'm a Rhodes Scholar. I've studied, mm-hmm. you know, regional accents for years and looked into what is the most likable. And I've lied to you this. If that happened, if someone ever pulled that off, that's a pretty compelling case.
It'd be a very compelling case. Yeah. So what evidence did Cass have that LJ was a con person?
Oh, man. Little. She... he told this story about, like... He to be fair, like LJ really did like play up the like mystique of the horse trainer and maybe like told stories in a way that were
hey, it worked for Trish,
right? A little grandiose. Oh, it worked for Trish. It worked very well. But he told this story about like, yeah, there was this Mustang that, you know, you couldn't tame him. He was a wild spirit. And you know, one
his
day
name was LJ.
He's like, I got up at 4 a.m. one morning and, you know, pulled out some Jameson, went to IHOP and said, I'm going to tame this horse.
IHOP?
IHOP somehow fit into the story, yeah. The International House of Pancakes.
Yes.
That's where you go when you have to fuel up to train horses. So it was kind of like an outlandish story and we all just were like, all right, LJ is just like trying to tell a story. But Cass... Cass got a big theory out of it that he was a con man.
Wow. So, who knew? I don't even know how we got to that from, the Crazy Tribal Council.
Yeah.
Did LJ then deny it in the same way that Adam did?
No. LJ played it pretty cool. LJ was just like very defensive and quiet very reserved and quiet and just kind of like, Cass, you know, I'd love to talk about this, later and tell you more about my profession. LJ must have like done something crazy in casting. He's such like a mild mannered guy, you know,
yeah.
It's like he's not going to be getting in too many fights. But no, Adam really like was the opposite. It seemed like which, you know, isn't the worst approach because you do expect someone who's wrongfully accused to be very adamant about defending themselves.
Yeah, he is adamant. Yeah.
No, I'm here to defend Adam. I think people are not giving him enough credit. And, you know, the last two episodes talking about like his social game and he's made all these mistakes. I think it's gotten a little overboard. I think
Good.
Adam's doing all right.
Let's talk about this because I think that Adam is somebody that I've seen a lot of comparisons. I've certainly made them myself of your first game in Survivor mm-hmm. and sort of like these, some of the issues that you had with, you know, trying to get people on board with these plans. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about what you're seeing that he's doing that you're liking.
Yeah, I mean... Well, first of all, like Adam did put himself in a good power position. I think he has a good ability to see a situation and have that instinct of how can I use this situation for my benefit. And he has a lot of good idea. Like I think his initial thought is often in the right place. You know, he sees Taylor go off and be ostracized and says, this is an opportunity for me to, you know, ingratiate myself. Like, do I think he should have shared his advantage? Probably not. You know, he probably was emphatic about it, but I think, you know, the idea made sense. And then you see him, the way he handled the situation where he was between Figgy and Taylor and then Sunday and was it Brett who were on that merge tribe where he was in the middle as the swing vote. I think he did a good job of just sort of laying back and waiting to be the swing vote. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's easy to see the scene with him and Jay in the water where Jay is like, oh, Adam's such a prick. He's just telling me all about how I'm on the bottom. He did say Jay was on the bottom, but that's the extent of it. You know, like the story was Adam's being a jerk by telling Jay the hard, bitter truth. But you didn't actually see Adam say anything other than you're on the bottom. So it's like one sentence we're criticizing to say his whole social game is just awful.
Well, let me say the counterpoint to this. And, you know, I do like Adam as a player, but I believe that if you and I are having a conversation and even if I say everything exactly right, but you get the wrong impression and I've offended mm-hmm. you, isn't that on me as the person delivering the message and not, doesn't the fault lie with me as the person who did not read you correctly in how I delivered this message to you?
Yeah, that's totally fair. I think if Jay's getting that impression, Adam did veer wrong at some point. I think the real question though is like, where did he veer wrong? Did he handle the conversation so disastrously that he took a guy who was pleased with him and made him upset? Or was Jay just going to be upset? And I tend to think Jay was going to be upset. I tend to think that Jay, Taylor, Will were pretty unhappy with Adam since he teamed up with the Gen Xers and Hannah and Zeke. And I don't know if Adam could have dug himself out of that hole. He didn't succeed in digging himself out of the hole, but I don't know that he necessarily dug it that much deeper.
Yeah, I think that Adam was really just trying to be a straight shooter and giving Jay, you know, this is sort of like the cold truth of what's going on here. And yeah. Jay's asking, like, am I on the bottom? Like, yeah, you're on the bottom. And I think that Jay might have been in denial about that. And he's like, what do you mean? Like, my, like,
it's true.
It's sort of like he was the messenger of this bad news of like, Jay, you're in a really bad spot right now. And I mean, you're to speak to your point, perhaps Jay was embellishing what he had heard from Adam to the other people to try to turn more people against him. But I also feel like that Jay was telling us the same thing in the confessional. So I sense that Jay was being authentic when he was telling everybody about how he felt like that Adam was rubbing his face in what was going on.
That's fair. You know, I'm sure that's fair that Jay felt that way. And if Jay, you know, has this sense that he's not on the bottom, yeah, I agree. You know, don't rain on that parade.
Yeah. And then just going back to the previous week with Taylor, I think it was the same sort of thing where Adam has, you know, this good idea of, okay, I know that here's a person that's upset with me. This is a relationship that I need to repair. But again, it's that same idea where I think he just misread how that was going to be received in the way that he delivered that message to Taylor.
Yeah, that's true. I think, he misread it. I guess, you know, I understand that these things could have gone better. I just think, you know, it's in practice, it's hard to, I don't know that he could have gone over and said anything to Taylor that would have, you know, totally won him over. You're a lot more likely to like Will, who is just, you know where he's at. He's with you. He's not fishing around for options. And he like, it's easy to be annoyed with that guy. You're going to be annoyed with the guy who's like wavering, you know, who's, it's like a hard position to make people not annoyed with you.
Well, let's dive deeper into this because I feel like that this is something that you had talked about that you wanted to try to improve between your first game and your second game. And you talked about this a lot, I think, during Cambodia in terms of making bonds with people as opposed to just making deals, because it does feel like that Adam is trying to go out and make these offers to people who he may not necessarily have a close connection with. And I think he feels like, as a lot of the viewers do, okay, I know what I need to do. I need to get this person on my side and I'll get this voting block or whatever together with these guys and then we'll move forward. But I just feel like that these guys are sort of in Jay and Taylor in back-to-back weeks, like, whoa, you know, hold up, bro.
I know.
Yeah.
It's hard. It's like, I am a big believer that you have to wait for the relationship before you start, you know, moving the pieces. And, I think that holds here. It's hard. You know, Adam's such a fan of the show and you can tell he really wants to start playing. And yeah, I have to guess just from what we've seen, the best thing for him to do is kind of like what Zeke did. You know, Zeke in the secret scenes talks about how early on he was like, people were like, stop talking to me. You're being too strategic. Like, you need to just relax. People didn't want to talk to him. And so he just stopped and started hanging out. And all of a sudden, slowly but surely, people are willing to talk to you again.
Yeah. But I'm interested to know, like, when you played with somebody like Tony and who was flying around all over the place and, you know, making these deals, not necessarily putting in the time to build a relationship, but ultimately getting people on his side when he needs it. Like, how is he just such a unicorn in that? Or is there something to what he's doing that we could take from that?
Tony is robot unicorn attack, if any kind of unicorn.
Yeah.
No, I think, it's, I don't know that you really can. Like, it's hard to take any pages out of the Tony playbook. Like,
there's nothing we can learn.
Nothing I can learn. maybe something that someone similar on the personality spectrum can learn, but Tony's just, he has this this skill set and this versatile personality that's able to really like dig himself out of those holes and be very in the moment with someone and persuade them emotionally. It's not something that anyone can pick up.
Okay. You know, speaking of Tony, you know, he also was conjured up this season in talking about this idea
this
of...
This is a Tony Vlachos game.
Yes, yes. That Will was bringing up in the Michaela Tribal Council about how, hey, we can't have somebody who's playing a Tony game. We need mm-hmm. to have around people that we can trust. If somebody mm-hmm. is playing a Tony game or we can't trust them, they need to be gone. We can't be dealing with somebody like this.
As he turns on Michaela.
Yes, as he was turning on Michaela, but I guess that sort of, and Michaela is saying, hey, we need to all be trusting our group. But mm-hmm. I think that Jay and Will probably felt like, okay, she's like a Tony in that we can't trust her. And mm-hmm. then
she's strategic and thinking a lot.
Right.
Like, yeah, planning ahead too much for their life. Yeah, that makes sense. I don't know. I think them turning on her is more Tony-esque than any anticipation they had of her becoming Tony mm-hmm. necessarily. But yeah, that fear is totally there. And I think it, you know, Tony paves the way. On one hand, you know, you see someone can play such a bold game and succeed. But on the other hand, it's like you put the fear of God into people if they even think you might be playing that way.
Yeah. I really feel like, Spencer, if I was playing again, and I know that I would have zero chance to be able to pull this off, I just feel like I would play the game at least, you know, through into the merge so slow. I would not be doing anything. And again, people are like, yeah, we saw this. It's called Survivor All-Stars. But I mean, even then, I feel like that's what I was thinking. I'm like, hey, what I need to do is get people to trust me. And to feel mm-hmm. like, hey, I have nothing up my sleeve right now. Like I'm just I'm being authentic with you. I'm not trying to pull anything off. This is, you know, this is who I am.
Yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense. I think like with All-Stars, what were you going to do? Right. Like it goes back to the question of you'd like to think that because you selected, you know, behavior A and you didn't get the result you wanted, behavior A was the wrong way to go. But maybe even if you had pulled out all the stops, even if you had been scheming with everyone, you just, you know, were in a bad spot.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think, you know, in theory, it makes a lot of sense to slow play it and just stick with your team, stay the course in the beginning. But also there's just so much out of your control.
There's so much pressure that is sort of internalized from the survivors to be like, okay, we gotta be making moves. It's better to make a move too soon than too late.
Well, that's true as well. I think, yeah, there is definitely a pressure. And like you're on a show, you want to be a good player, especially with like people playing the first time, they want to make their mark. It's really tempting to err on the side of the big move. And I think, you know, you almost see like Jay after he votes Michaela out. Actually, I loved when he voted Michaela out and he was just like stone cold gangster. Like, I did it.
Yeah.
And that was awesome. But when he, after that, like, I feel like he almost adopted that gunslinger mentality. Like, okay, now this is the game I'm playing. And so I think it's like really tempting to get into that.
Yeah. One of the things that we saw in this season is this advantage that Adam has, which is the advantage of being able to steal a reward from mm-hmm. somebody, which we all sort of scoffed last week about. Like, this is a pretty weak sauce advantage.
It was the second take when he was acting happy about finding that. Like the first time he's like, oh, I thought this was an idol. This is awful.
This isn't exactly the Tyler Perry idol that I can steal an advantage. But, you know, you played in two different seasons, each with somebody who had this type of advantage, where Tony had the Tyler Perry idol, which he was able to use very much to his advantage. Steven also had the advantage of the vote steal, which was a big factor in that season as well. So how much does the idea of somebody having an advantage, no matter what it is, change the perception of a person.
Yeah, I think it's enormous. I think it's a disadvantage to have an advantage, and it's known, and it's not that great. Like, I think if I were Adam, I would play it immediately. I would, the next, like, whatever it is, food reward, I would play it immediately, given that everyone knows he has it. That's mm-hmm. the key. Just get rid of it, because if he holds on to it, people are going to say, oh, he's being strategic. He's waiting for that final four reward challenge, which is a chance to win advantage in the final immunity. And then he becomes a much more appealing person to vote out final six, final five.
But at what point does going for the advantage help your cause? I mean, do you need to be in a situation where it's like, okay, I'm the next person to go, so I have to go for the advantage? And if you're in any sort of a secure spot, don't go near the advantage?
Well, no, I don't think it's that simple. I think it's, you know, it's obviously cost benefit. Like, if I remember on Cambodia, you know, both Steven and I go for the advantage that turned out to be stealing a vote. And I don't think either of us thought we were totally on the bottom at that moment, but we thought we don't have a great chance of winning this challenge. And, you know, if the environment is such that everyone is strategic and knows everyone's being strategic, I think you might as well go for it. And then if you really are worried about the target, just play it immediately. You know, I think Steven would tell you if he could do it over again, he would have played the advantage immediately, because the fear of it definitely looms very heavily. And I'm sure there's a fear that Adam's lying about what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Or there would have been, rather, if Taylor hadn't been the one to announce what it was.
So how should he have handled things differently?
Taylor or
Adam?
Or Adam? I think Adam should not have told Taylor that he found it.
Mm-hmm.
Given that Taylor did blow up his spot, you know, I think he really can't do much. I think just play it soon, probably, so that people don't start really thinking you're going to rip their love. What did he say? Rip their loved ones out of their arms.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. I think he should just play it immediately. But as far as what he could have done, just don't tell anyone. If you can find it in secret, keep it in secret. If it isn't in secret, play it.
What do you think he should do with it now? Just he needs to play at the next reward challenge that they have?
I'd think so. It's also, honestly, it's a liability also in the sense that it's going to piss someone off.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's like whenever he does use it, it's probably not going to go over well, especially if it ends up excluding the person that won it. Like, he doesn't want to use it probably on a team reward challenge. He probably wants to use it on an individual reward challenge and then at least pick the person who won the reward. Just because, you know, he already is not, you know, you have Taylor's on the jury, Jay's going to be on the jury, Michelle is going to be talking to them on the jury, and Will's going to be on the jury. So I think it's time, you know, he really does need to start thinking about, he can't make too many more enemies, right?
The problem for Adam is that he just needs some good press. Like, everything about him has been negative, really, since the merge happened. That everybody's just like, oh, freaking Adam, what is he doing now? What is he? Is an advantage? Come on, Adam. Everybody is annoyed with him.
It's so extreme. Like, what has Adam really done? What has Adam done that's so
He's had good intentions. He's had good intentions, but it's just that it is not working. And I feel like he just needs to, rather than go and steal everybody's reward at the next trial, or the next reward challenge to get rid of this mm-hmm. reward, he just needs mm-hmm. to sort of like go a vote or two where nobody's talking about him. He needs to get back under the radar.
Lay low. He, maybe he can, I don't know, steal a reward no one wants. Like, you get a reward where you have to go to a town and find a goat, like get a goat and bargain with people. Then he can steal that.
They were happy to get that in Africa.
Were they though?
I think so. They were happy to go leave and go somewhere, I think.
That's true. They were just in like a barren desert lochland.
Yeah. Why? What's the worst reward that you had in your Survivor seasons?
In any of them?
Yeah.
Probably the spa day in Cambodia.
Yes.
You know, it didn't really show it, but the spa day, it started raining the second we got to the Survivor spa.
Mm-hmm.
And the food was like not rain friendly food. It was quiche and all the stuff that we ended up eating like in soup form. And then we're getting our massages and it's like a cold rain on us while we're getting massaged and we're like shivering, like, this is great.
Mm-hmm.
So that wasn't the best.
Not ideal. So he should steal that.
I got to see Joe's hair in its best form. So there was a silver lining.
Yeah, that is a silver lining. I want to get your take on how this merge is going to unfold, because now we've had two people that go out from the Triforce back to back in Michelle and Taylor. And yeah. Now seemingly Jay and Will are at the bottom. We have sort mm-hmm. of like this big 9-person alliance, which I'm sure you know from Cambodia, it just is going to collapse under its yes. own weight yes. at yeah. any point. And I don't think it's going to yeah. be a straight shot where Will and Jay ultimately are the next two people who go home. So mm-hmm. how do you feel like that this big 9-person thing is going to crack?
I think you said it. I think, well, I don't think you said how they'll crack, but I think they will. I think it's probably going to come from fractures within Gen X. And this isn't based on the preview. Like, I think there's a lot that's hinting toward this already. One thing that sticks out to me from early on is you have that confessional of David saying he is going to turn on a Gen X as soon as it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that was just set up for Chris and he turning on Cece. It seems like, you know, that might have been more important, that we might see David make a move pretty soon against other Gen Xers. So I think it could easily originate from him. And then there are kind of factions within that. There's, you know, Brett and Sunday and who are they tight with? Brett and Sunday.
I guess Chris is the one person that they're tight with.
Yeah, yeah. Brett, Sunday, and Chris, I feel like, are kind of on one side. And then David and company are on the other. And I could easily see David sort of cutting that line. And yeah. I feel like it's like I could see Jay going really deep. I could see Jay winning, because the bigger the number disparity is, I feel like the more likely it is the minority will have a chance. I think the 4-5 minorities actually fare worse often than the 2-9 or 2-7 minorities, because the majority feels so comfortable and sees it has so much time and can lose so many numbers and still have control over that minority that they can go ahead and start turning on each other. And like Steven's first season, Jalapau, it was like 8-3. I think yeah. you see that, you know, repeatedly.
Yeah, I think it might have been, I don't know if it was quite 8-3. I think it might have been 6-3 or maybe 7-3.
Oh yeah, because I know Joe Dowdle
got medevaced at the merge.
I mean, but there's more than there's Samoa. It's I think there are a lot of examples.
Yeah, that's 8-4, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, certainly going back to in Cambodia, where you have, is that a 9-person alliance also? And then they have the three yeah. witches.
Yes. When we had the coven and like 11 votes for Kelly Wentworth. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, and Kelly's right there all the way to you until the final four, yep. you know, and it is immunity challenge away from making it to the final three. So, I mean, that's a good example of that. And I think the thing that really helps them also is that Jay has the idol. And we know from the previews that there's going to start to be a lot of publicity about the fact that Jay has the idol. And it seems like it's stemming from Will, which seems pretty counterintuitive. Wouldn't you think if that there are only two potential people to vote out, is that a good idea to tell everybody that the other alternative to voting against you is somebody that has an idol?
Yeah, I don't know.
If you and Tasha are at the bottom, like, is it a good idea to tell everybody, hey, guess what, everybody, Tasha has the idol?
It's iffy. It's really iffy. Because it's like, if I don't know, you want them to want to flush it out.
Mm-hmm.
So, but if you get caught, then it's automatic. You're going home.
But yeah, because, you're the other person.
Exactly. So it's extremely, extremely risky.
And it's not good.
Yeah, it's not good. I don't know. What did you think of Jay sitting on the idol?
In terms of not playing it?
Yeah.
It's tough. I mean, I don't know if he got any assurance that it was going to be Taylor. He did put his vote on Taylor, but I think right. that Will put his vote on Jay. So I don't know exactly what he was told in terms of, hey, you're going to be safe tonight. Spencer, I've never had a hidden immunity idol, but I feel like if I did have one, I think I would probably end up wanting to play it, because I would be more afraid of going home with it in my pocket and playing it, mm-hmm. you know, and not playing it as opposed to playing it at the wrong time.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, people think, oh, you know, not playing an idol, getting voted out, that's bad. Playing an idol and you didn't need to, that's bad. But one is a lot worse than the other. And I think even if there's, you know, a 30% chance you're going to be going home, unless Jay was really confident that Taylor was not going to turn and vote for Jay, that he was going to stick with voting for Adam, I think he should play it.
Yeah. But I know that when we talked after Survivor Kagiyan, I remember that you had said that you felt like your biggest regret that you had from that game was that mm-hmm. you had the hidden immunity idol and you feel like that you played it at the wrong time. You had said that you wanted to give it to Jeffra at that point. So am I right in thinking it's better to walk away from the game playing your idol at potentially the wrong time than to risk walking out of the game with it and saving it for a rainy day?
Yeah, no, you're right. Because I think my thing with Jeffra was different. My big regret wasn't that I played it necessarily or that I used it, but it was that I wasted it. It was that I had the opportunity to use it as bargaining power to go to Jeffra and say, look, like if you do want to come on our side, you know, before maybe it didn't look that appealing, 4-4, you don't want to sign up for, you know, a tie when you have a guaranteed majority. But with this idol, there's a shot now, you know, if we can play this right, then we actually, this is a majority. So I think it was more about, you know, I had an opening to use the idol, and take a good calculated risk.
Yeah. Just sticking with that idol. So you ultimately found the clue at the reward challenge that you went to, and then you came right. home, and then Wu ultimately stole the clue. Is there any parallel for you in terms of what Adam was dealing with and when Wu stole the clue from you?
In terms of what Adam was dealing with?
Yeah, at Tribal Council with being sort of outed as, hey, everybody, guess what Adam has?
Not really, because it was just a clue, right? Like, it's... I got caught having a clue and then was, like, incredibly lucky that I found the idol without anyone seeing me find the idol.
Mm-hmm.
The one parallel I think that does exist is it makes you look like you didn't tell your alliance members about the idol or about the clue. But I think, like, the further Survivor goes along, the less big a deal that is. I think people sort of almost expect that, okay, you found an idol. I think we're past the days of alliance members being upset with you for not having shared it with them.
Yeah. How do you sort of fill everybody in after the fact?
So I, you know, in my case, I was like, look, I wanted to take this chance to find it really quick. I thought I could get off and I had some time. Clearly now I don't. Let's all go find it. And luckily, I mean, no one really grilled me on it. After that, I think maybe people were like a little peeved, but no one was outwardly, you know, PO'd. I think, you know, if it is clear that you're just like a lone wolf with no regard for your alliance, you know, that's a tough spot. So you have to make sure you don't get caught, you know, in that situation. But I think in Survivor today, people expect that you're going to, if you have a chance to get an idol, that you're going to go for it and you might not tell everyone immediately. I think, you know, as long as you still have that alliance frame of mind and you still are willing, you know, if a good opportunity presents itself to play it on your alliance member, then people will still trust you.
And if it's good news that people are ready to forgive you, right? If you're on my team and it's like, hey, guess what? You know, I've got the hidden immunity idol. Good. Thank God. Okay, good. This
yes,
is good
I could
news.
Have gotten more screwed because it was like, oh, Spencer, you found the clue and you didn't share it. Oh, we also don't have the idol.
Yes.
So Adam's in that way, he's in a better spot.
You know, Adam, we touched on a little bit of Taylor with stealing the food, but do you have any strong feelings about what Taylor did with the food as a Survivor player? Does it really bother you that he did this? Or do you feel like, hey, good on him for pulling this off or at least attempting it?
Oh, God.
He didn't pull it off, but he attempted it.
Did he, though? He when questioned about whether he acknowledged his the fact that what he was doing was hurting people, he said, oh, definitely. So I don't know if he was even trying to pull anything off. I don't really know what he was doing. I don't think he was really taking the game seriously.
Yeah.
Like, that's the only conclusion I can come up with, that he just wasn't taking any of it seriously, that, you know, he would at least put in the college try to say, you know, oh, I acknowledge that I was, you know, upsetting everyone, that I stole everyone's food. But there was like none of that. I'm not like on a soapbox saying it's a morally reprehensible to steal food. How could he, you know, this has happened. Many survivors have stolen food here or there, probably not on Taylor levels, but it does happen. I just think, you know, like if it were gameplay, if he had any, you know, sense at all, he would be seeing he got caught red-handed and taking some kind of different action.
Yeah, it's a really good question as to what his intentions are. I mean, I had said with Figgy and Taylor, I felt like that the story of them was a story of arrogance and hubris, going back to the fact they're like, hey, we're together. Like, who cares? They can't stop us. And then to the point where then she gets voted out, then it's like, you know, I don't care if I'm going to lose the game as long as I take out Adam. And then even right. with this food, like, I don't care who gets mad. I'm just going to eat my stuff. So yeah, it's a really good point. And one that I do wish, like, you know, was there any desire for real to change up anything about himself to attempt to win the game? Or it was only like, sure, I'll win the game if everybody does it on my terms.
Yeah. I'm going to go with the hard no.
Yeah.
There was none. He even said in his Ponderosa video, like, the what he thought Figgy meant by win was just to not give up or something. Like, I just don't think he was in it to win the game. I don't think he was taking any of it seriously. I feel bad for everyone in the situation. I feel bad for little John Snowboard. I feel bad for
John Snowboard.
I feel bad for everyone Taylor has come in contact with.
Is that a Game of Thrones reference?
Yeah, he's. I don't want to be mean. These people have real lives that are going to be affected.
Yeah.
I just feel bad. I don't think Taylor was taking anything seriously. It's a sad story.
He does seem to have an issue with sort of being able to project the future based on if I take action A, then B happens. He seems to have a little bit of a disconnect with that.
Yeah. Well, see, no, the thing is, I think he actually can, like, see it, but just literally doesn't care. I think he sees, you know, if I steal the food, I'll hurt everyone. If I, you know, act like an ass, like, it'll upset people. And I think he just, like, is like, yeah, that will happen. That's going to happen. I'll just do that.
Yeah. Are you saying he's like a Joker character? He just wants to watch the world
burn?
Watch
the world burn. No, I mean, I'm sure there's, you know, a human inside him who does care about people. I'm sure it's not just completely, he has an like complete disregard for everyone, but it does come across that way.
I want to ask you about some of the other players this season. Will is somebody we've talked a lot about. And again, you were a young lad when you played in Cagayan but 2 or 3 years ago. But I mean, for you, you must be, this is the first time you really get to look at a survivor like these, boy, these kids today.
Yeah. Poor Will. Yeah. It's, I think, like, when you're that young, like, it's hard to be, like, you have to work a little bit to be taken seriously. So I think I've got to, like, commend Will that it does seem like people respect him. They take him seriously. Mm-hmm. You know, he's formed good allies or good alliances. I think he's, you know, he's holding his own, but it's, at the end of the day, I think he has to probably play an outstanding game to get the credit as, you know, the strategic player. And it seems like, you know, more of the credit is unfortunately going to Jay. And I think people have even said, you know, Will is just kind of in Jay's pocket.
Mm-hmm.
So whether that's the perception or the reality, it's going to be the reality of the jury that's voting.
But going back to when you first played in Cagayan, and you were what, 22 or you were 21 when you played?
I just turned 21.
Okay.
So I could drink alcohol.
You could drink alcohol. Yes. A pineapple Rita or two.
Like, it seemed like Jeff was, like, getting off on telling Will that he
no!
couldn't drink.
No, you get nothing.
There were no more poles in the challenge. He had all this pent up energy. He had to release to someone.
Yeah. But in your original tribe, in the Brains tribe, I mean, so here you are, you're 21 years old. I mean, who is the closest person in age to you? I mean, you're probably, what, at least 10 years younger than everybody else there.
No, you know, I think Garrett was 27. there was, the girls were young. Jeffra was 25.
Yeah, but she's not Morgan on the tribe with you were, when you start the game.
True. The Brains tribe, no. Garrett was the youngest after me, and he was 27. So that, yeah, that was, on one hand, I was kind of bummed about the age thing, but I think more good than the age was bad was the fact that I was on a Brains tribe, mm-hmm. and I didn't have to pretend I wasn't a nerd. I didn't have to like act, you know, not into Survivor or anything. I was kind of at home in that sense. So I, overall, I was grateful.
Yeah. And then even in Takeo, right? I mean, is there anybody else that was quite that young in that tribe?
No, that was an old cast. Cambodia was.
Yeah.
It was, yeah, that was, I mean, Kelly Wentworth was 29, I think, 28.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No one, really no one.
Yeah. And so how do you play that to your advantage in terms of trying to like, just make people feel like you're sort of like the kid brother and mm-hmm. non-threatening?
Yeah. I think you just have to fill the role that's possible for you to fill. You just have to, in some cases, accept that you're not going to be able to fill the role of the really highly respected peer and equal, and so you have to assume the role of either the understudy or like a son figure and be like, hey, like, you know, I have a lot I can learn from you, which, you know, I think like I formed some relationships in that mold as far as, and they were genuine in that, you know, I did admire, you know, how a lot of the people out there had lived their lives and did feel like I had things in life that I could learn. But yeah, it's even if I wasn't looking to be the mentee to someone's, you know, mentor, sometimes I kind of felt like I had to play that part.
Could you talk a little bit about David and what you've thought of him this season? Because oh, yeah. I'm wondering if you feel any connection with him.
No, I like David. I definitely feel a connection in that, you know, he just articulates the fears that I think are very common of, you know, you're afraid you're not going to fit in a tribe when you play Survivor. You're afraid you're just going to mess things up and be ostracized. And he, like, I think it's awesome that he went on the show, felt that, and then just was honest about it, said what he felt. I felt that before. So yeah, David's a great character. Great for the show. Like the way he will just take what's happening and really authentically say it. I think that's why we've, you know, seen him on the screen a lot. He's being really authentic.
He has something in common with you in that he has recreated a lot of Survivor's puzzles and practiced them before he goes out on the island.
Yeah. See, the thing is, David, I'm sure, did his homework way more than I did. I literally studied like the one puzzle that came up and maybe one other puzzle. My luck was obscene that the puzzle I studied came up. But no, I like, especially Survivor really does reuse things. I don't know why people don't do this more, why mm-hmm. there aren't more super fans who are like, yep, know that puzzle. It's low hanging fruit.
Mm-hmm. I spoke to Cass recently on the voicemail podcast, and she had said that every Survivor combination lock are the same numbers. It's always the same numbers that are in any sort of like combination lock that you have to solve. I believe that was disproven. I haven't touched on this again, but I believe that Cass's theory was not correct.
I was going to say, I didn't know that would have been huge. I can say that, for example, in the puzzle that there was a reward challenge in Cambodia with a puzzle where you had to put together three numbers, and I do think they were the same numbers. So I think maybe when a challenge is recycled, they use the same numbers, but it's not like there are three magical numbers that appear in every puzzle.
Okay. All right. So we'll see if we can drill down.
Was that definitely disproved, or you're just skeptical?
No, we had a screenshot that they were not the same numbers as the last three numbers that we had to, I believe it was in the seventh episode from this season. So 2 weeks ago.
Got it. Yeah. I don't know. I never would have thought that. I don't know.
Okay, we haven't touched too much on Zeke. How do you feel like Zeke is doing?
Oh, Zeke's great. He's like I said before, I really admire that. I feel like he did something really gracefully that I strived to do, which was he realized people perceived him as really strategic and sort of took a step back and relaxed and focused on building relationships first. And it really paid off that it seems like everyone does trust him. He's got many ways he could go, and he might be one of the people in the driver's seat, even if it is going to be a Gen X fracture that turns the game. I think he could be one of the people in the driver's seat as far as being a swing vote within that fracture and deciding, you know, which side he goes forward with. So I think, you know, at the very beginning of the season, you asked Jeff, like, not you, but we asked, there was an interview where Jeff said his four reasons why he thought the season was going to be good. And one of them literally was just Zeke. So something is coming. I think Zeke's going to be definitely involved in some power moves to come.
Well, it's interesting because as you mentioned with these Gen Xers, that there's six Gen Xers and you really could sort of like see like the fault line where they could come apart, where you have Sunday, Brett and Chris that are sort of the people that were, I guess, aligned earlier on in the season with Paul. And then you have the people mm-hmm. that Ken and David and Jessica, the people like that really did not like Paul. It's funny right, that Paul is right. like this figure that's that we're like, you know, there's still like battle lines over. But then, I mean, Zeke is the one person that has connections with, you know, both groups there, where he has the connection with Chris, where mm-hmm. they sort of have like a mini like Cliff Robinson and Wu thing going on. And then you also have, you know, that he's got this connection with David as well. So he could go whatever way the wind blows.
Yeah, he's in a good spot. Do you think Paul is like the specialist in that he made the division three amigos versus all the others and it's stuck?
Yes. I probably was going to compare him to more of a BB6 Cappy, but that's probably a bit before your time.
Little bit. Yeah.
And I know you're not always on top of the Big Brother.
I'm not an expert. Unfortunately,
no, that's fine. No one is going to hold that against you. So this is what I want to ask you about with Hannah. We've seen Hannah, you know, throughout the season, you know, she's unsure of herself at times. Going back a couple of weeks, she had this panic attack where mm-hmm. medical had to come in. Now, I know that in your podcasting, and certainly it's an area that you're especially interested in, you know, you're studying the idea of, you know, mental illness. Would you say, is panic attack on at all that same sort of plane as mental illness, or is that something totally different? And please forgive me if I am, you know, totally off base here.
Well, first of all, to everyone, forgive me, because I, you know, in this podcast, I don't pretend to be an expert or a psychiatrist or someone with any relevant degree. I was an econ major. I really am just curious about exploring this stuff myself, but you know, I do have a perspective on it. And what I think is it's definitely in that realm, you know, a proclivity to have a panic attack. I'm sure, you know, Hannah would say is associated with, you know, some anxiety and is certainly something that could be considered a disorder. I think a lot of, you know, what we want to accomplish in the podcast is to be inclusive in those discussions as far as what can or can't be considered a disorder, and to sort of normalize the actual term disorder, to stop it from being something of, oh, you know, you have this condition, you must be this way. That's something extreme and on the fringe, and this little panic attack, that couldn't be the same thing. I think the more we consider it all on the same spectrum, the more we can normalize it and realize that everyone struggles with things like this to some degree or another. And it might not necessarily be the discrete diagnosis that you would find, you know, in a handbook or that's clearly objectively defined. It can be very much on a spectrum. And I think, you know, Hannah maybe it could relate to a lot of people on that spectrum, and that there's nothing abnormal about that.
I got to listen to the first show that you guys put out in the podcast, and you told a very personal story about how you had been dealing with depression from a very young age. Could you just tell a shorter version of that for people listening to this podcast?
Yeah, absolutely. When I was a kid, when I was, you know, 10 years old, I started getting really depressed. I was in this situation where I was starting to really come to see people in different ways and see my parents differently and feel kind of alone and a little bit hopeless. And so I started expressing these feelings and I went to a psychiatrist and was diagnosed with being depressed. I went on an antidepressant, and this big issue sort of arose in my life around that whole experience where there was a big conflict around me over whether it was okay for me to be on this antidepressant and whether that was the appropriate course of action. And the stigma around antidepressants and depression and the notions of those things that we collectively hold caused a big fight over whether I should be on the pills. And so ultimately the result was that I felt all that pressure and told the psychiatrist, I don't need the pills. I'm fine, and went off of them. And just like that, you know, in a 6-month period, the whole thing was done with, and I was left sort of feeling how I had been feeling before, really confused. And I think like what I can learn from that experience, rather than, you know, pinning it on any one person involved or any one cog in the machine, is that as a society, we really have a view of mental disorder that makes it very hard for those who suffer from it, that makes it hard for them to talk openly about it, to openly say they need help. And I think the biggest step, or one of the biggest steps we can take toward helping those people, is talking about it and working through that stigma. And I see it even with, as we're starting this podcast, we're scheduling guests, we're getting going. People, very understandably, are hesitant to talk about the issues they've faced. So many people face stuff like this. It's really common. It's all around us. And so few people will talk about it. You don't see many politicians talking about or admitting to having mental disorders. You don't see many CEOs talking about struggling with this stuff. We don't allow people to talk about it openly without judgment. And ironically, the only way people can sort of, I think, find community and connection and work their way through it is by having that freedom to work through it.
And I think it's a really noble thing that you're doing with starting up the podcast. And I know that it's going to help a lot of people. You know, I've heard from many different people over the course of like doing this podcast for many years, of people have told me that, you know, that at different times that they've dealt with battling bouts of depression and just having some sort of like something as silly as what we do on the podcast, but having it sort of like routinely, you know, in their schedule and something to look forward to, you know, that I've, you know, it's a nice feeling to know that in some way, you know, we've been able to help some people also with that. And, you know, I if that's sounding like a humble brag, I'm trying to say that's totally legitimate. You know, for people that are feeling that way, it's, you know, hopefully it's reassuring to know that there are other people that are out there dealing with the same thing that you are. So Spencer, in terms of then with you playing Survivor, going through everything with playing the second time in Cambodia, I mean, how much were you dealing with this then going through as the season was airing, dealing with like negative criticism after the season was over? Because the thing that I sort of like, the light bulb that went off for me when I was listening to you talk about all of this stuff was that I was like, oh, you know, I remember about a year ago and we went through the finale and I remember like seeing you and I felt like that you looked so down. And I remember like, you know, Spencer, like everything is okay. Like, you know, cheer up. Don't be so sad. And I felt like that, you know, what an insensitive person I was to try to tell you how to feel.
Well, no, I mean, I think what you had was perspective and, you know, I didn't have perspective and, you know, maybe you were a little frustrated that, wow, like how does he not see that Survivor is a game and that life is much bigger? And so you kind of wanted to just like shake the truth into me, which you can't really do. Like I think you have to let people find perspective, truth, whatever, at their own pace, on their own terms. And yeah, I remember, like, you know, after all the red carpet interviews were done with, we sort of were like, you know, talking. I went by and started talking to you, and you started, you know, saying, you know, I hope, like, you're feeling okay. You really, like, have your head on right about this. And, like, the more you were talking, I just started getting upset. I was, like, about to cry. Yeah, I think, like, you witnessed, like, a really vulnerable, dark moment for me that was very, I was very sad and crushed. And I think it had everything to do with, I was so zoomed in on Survivor, and my perspective was that Survivor was so important. And yeah, I think slowly but surely I've gotten a little bit more to that zoomed out big picture view that you had of it, which is, you know, it's not what you wanted, but life goes on and there's a lot more to it. And so, yeah, I think if providing a community where people are able to share their stories and relate to one another helps people get that perspective and see other people are struggling with things, relate to other people, participate in a community, which, like, honestly, very legitimately, that's what you've built. That's what RHAP is. It's a community. And if that can help people get that perspective, work through what they're dealing with, I think, whether it's about Survivor, whether it's about mental disorder, I'm so passionate about building that.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, really amazing that, you know, you're dedicating time to work on this. I mean, if I remember, I feel like that when I saw you that night when you were at the finale, like, I mm-hmm. just, like, wanted, you know, to say to you, like, you know, the next the amazing thing that you're going to do is going to have nothing to do with Survivor, but there's, you know, so many things that you're going to go on to do. You know, I just was, you know, really hoping that you would be able to see that. And, you know, I saw you over the summer and you seemed like mm-hmm. you were, you know, everything was going great. So, you know, I'm very happy to see, you know, how well things are going for you.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Papa Sestrino.
Well, they made me feel really old.
Dominic and Anthony are in good hands.
Yeah.
No, yeah, I appreciate it. I think, like, it's time has definitely helped, and I do feel, you know, like, I have a much better perspective on everything now.
Mm-hmm. But it is one of my weaknesses also to, you know, and something I've dealt with loved ones, with just sort of like, but don't be sad. Like, yeah, everything's fine. Everything's fine. Like, stop. Why are you doing this? And believe it's and that's, definitely I mean,
that's
something.
Like, that's one of the big frustrations, I think. And, you know, the, like, part of our mission is to give a place where people with struggling with, you know, disorders can listen and relate. But a whole other side of it is to allow people without disorders to bridge that disconnect, where I think your experience is so common, if you aren't struggling with anything, to hear someone who is and say, why don't you, like, get up and take a walk? Like, it's fine. Just like, smile. Like, you can choose to be happy. It's fine. And I think, you know, people might feel very frustrated if they're in that position, or if they love someone or know someone who struggles with this stuff. And I think the podcast hopefully will really help toward understanding, not only relating, but toward understanding.
Okay. All right. Well, let me try to do what I do and try to lighten the mood again. And I keep doing it. But let me ask you some of these questions that I have for you from the listeners of the podcast. And why don't I start off with asking you about this question from David Baltazar, who says, Spencer, you've always managed to maneuver out of the bottom in both of your seasons. What are the essential tools you need to accomplish this? Do you see Adam and Jay being able to do this?
There's one essential tool. It's dumb luck. and Tony Vlachos being on your season. But
that wasn't the case in Cambodia.
True, true. And in Cambodia, I think it was very much based on self-awareness and getting some self-awareness, because I did, in the very beginning of Cambodia, I went right back into old tendencies to treat people analytically and not connect and not form relationships and not really wait for those relationships to form and just start playing and moving and calculating. And starting on day 7, I really did shift toward letting the game come to me, getting to know people, and waiting for the ideas to come up, waiting for people to propose things, and then going on board. You know, you want to be the Will who doesn't seem to have a ton of legs to stand on, rather than the Adam who seems to be looking for options everywhere. And I say this as an Adam fan, you know, who seems to be really working all angles, you know, whether or not the relationships are there. So I think the path is, you know, really based on seeing the need, seeing how you need to adapt what you're doing and how your personality might have gotten you where you are, and correct course. But I think at the same time, sometimes you end up on the bottom really just because Survivor is a fickle game. And I don't necessarily think Jay needs to do anything to dramatically correct course or change himself. I think I have high hopes for someone in his position who maybe it's now an opportune time that he'll benefit from some changes in the game.
Okay. Similarly, James Cone says, "Hey, Spencer, this is your boy, James, from University of Chicago. My question is about Adam's conversation with Jay in the water last night. How would you compare the way Adam made Jay feel that he is on the bottom to the way Tony made you feel when you were on the bottom? Can Adam leverage his position like Tony did? Thanks, guys. Bring RJP back to Chi-Town." Now, I recall vividly when, you know, back in Cagayan, where you and Jeremy / Jeremiah were on a reward with Tony, where I guess that was, must have been what, Final Nine, because you were in teams of three.
Yes. Yeah, it was. Yeah.
And you guys had, was that also a spa reward?
Yes.
You're always on spa rewards.
That was the good spa reward.
Yeah. The good spa reward.
I'm going to become the spa reward critic.
The spa, yeah, like Keith Nail. And then, was the difference there that you and Jeremiah knew you were on the bottom and you were sort of talking to Tony? You know, he was in a position of power. You guys knew where you stood, as opposed to Jay being sort of like, "Wait, what do you mean I'm on the bottom?"
Yeah, I think that's part of the difference, because Tony was pretty upfront with us as far as saying, you know, like, "Look, I know you guys don't have options," because also part of Tony's game is, you know, like intimidation. Tony wants to leave you with the impression that if you go and pull a fast one, he will use his power against you rather than with you. So I think, you know, I wouldn't say Tony was like super tactful, but he chose the exact right time to do what he did and say what he said. And I think certainly the only time you'd ever want to have a conversation with someone where you are, you know, really making a point of saying they're on the bottom is if you're right about ready to make a move with them, and you're at the same time giving them that encouragement that things are going to get better. You never want to say like, "You're on the bottom. Who knows if it'll stay that way or not. Sorry, man. Might be able to help you, might not." Tony was a lot more encouraging. And I think like people do want that hope, you know, like if you're going to say someone's on the bottom, then seem really game to make a move with them. Not like Albert Destrade, but like at least seem really willing to play ball and really hopeful that, you know, things can change. And Tony also was very, you know, he came off cocky at many times, but he was also humble about his own position. He constantly talked about how his own people could turn on him and how he was worried. And probably it was genuine. He was a paranoid guy.
Mm-hmm. How do you deal with dealing with the people that are on the bottom, though, and then not have them go and sell you out? Because I had this experience in Survivor of the Amazon with Jenna, where I was like, "Hey, guess what? You know what? You're on the bottom, but I'd like to take you to the final two because I feel like I can beat you. You're going to get voted out next, probably. So work with me and we'll go to the end." And instead, which like my brain was not able to process why somebody would do that. "I'm offering you to go to final two. Why would you try to blow me up at, you know, final six?" And, but that's what happened. And I was able to luckily to deflect and be like, "I don't even know what she's talking about." Like I just told her that to make her happy. Like I didn't really mean it. And luckily the people I was working with all were like, "Oh, okay, sure. If you say so, Rob." But I was lucky that I, you know, that they weren't more, you know, inquiring into like, "Wait, hold on. Why did you do that? Are you serious? Like, I don't know. Should we trust you?"
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I don't know. That's, again, though, that's like, I don't, you can't beat yourself up too much about that. I mean, like, did you really, could you have seen that coming, that she would, I mean, certainly you could have done it differently, but
I would say, I mean, if we're going to get into critiquing my game, I mean, that I didn't need to, like, I didn't need to clear that with her. If I wanted to just do that, then, you know, I could have just, you know, done that. I didn't need to, like, you know, get her permission.
Explain
to
your rationale.
Right. And tell her all the details of, hey, I think I can also beat you. Also, I did not get her enrolled in the plan like I should have. And, right. you know, what I have said about this before in the evolution strategy is that it also didn't help that I was severely hungover that day, where I don't think I did anything. And we were sort of waiting for the other shoe to drop with Brett with getting drunk.
Yeah. Johnny Fairplay would be very proud of Survivor's newfound emphasis on alcohol consumption.
Yes. A very boozy season. I would say that maybe I was not, you know, didn't have all of my faculties about myself when I was dealing with such a strong headache and a lack of Advil. So maybe a clearer head might not again, that everything, it was a good TV moment. It didn't really change the outcome of anything. So, right, you know, I don't really beat myself up over it, but it was a good lesson learned.
Yeah. It's tough. It's tricky. I think it is. It's also, you know, very much the people you're talking to. Like I probably never would have blown up Tony's spot, even when maybe I should have, you know. You could argue that I should have gone to LJ and told him about what Tony was planning and then gotten Tony out in that round. So it's, you can definitely, you might even,
but that's such revisionist history. I mean, there's no way, like, why would you just, like, are saying that now because that was the only round that Tony was vulnerable for the entire game. So it's like, if you sort of like knew everything from the end working backwards, like, oh yeah, what I could have done there. But I mean, in the
present moment, I think if you had told me, do you want LJ out or do you want Tony out? I would have said Tony, but I felt that the risk was too great. And I chose the more passive option of just going with Tony's plan. Mm-hmm. So I'm not really saying that I zigged where I should have zagged, but I'm saying you could certainly point to that. You could certainly question that.
Yeah. Tim Connolly wants to know, what type of information would need to come out during a tribal council to make you change your vote?
Probably not.
Did that ever happen
to
you?
No, never happened to me. Mm-hmm. It certainly wouldn't change my mind what happened in this tribal council, that someone won or found an advantage of stealing a reward. It would have to be something that suggests like a fundamental change in the game dynamic, that, you know, these two people had an alliance or had a conversation when my ally swore they didn't, or something like that.
Okay. Johnny Iosum wants to ask you, not trying to be results oriented, but how bad was Adam's move to vote out Figgy? I feel like that it would have been much easier to maneuver through the alliance of Figtails and Jay Shell rather than the smarter Gen X group who've already seen him flip once. So if we were just going to play this out, the alternate history version of, okay, instead of when Adam voted out Figgy, he stuck with Figtails. They're still there. They're still liking him as sort of like the kid brother, third wheel of Figtails. Plus, then I guess Ken is gone. I forget who actually got the votes.
Oh, that's right. It was Ken and...
Did Ken get the votes? What? So one of them would be gone. Let's just say Ken is gone. So now Gen X Jessica is there. The first vote after the merge, you feel like that Adam has stuck now with the group of, you know, and maybe Hannah stays there too. So it does feel like that Adam might be in less hot water if he ended up sticking with Figgy and Taylor. I applauded the move at the time, but could we go back and look at that as a bad move?
I think you could. I think not, because the Gen Xers are so much smarter, and because necessarily like he chose the wrong allies, but more that he chose the wrong enemies. I think...
Wow, that's heavy.
I think that the big thing is Taylor was a very vindictive person, whereas the Gen Xers probably would not have held as emotional of a grudge. Because again, my working theory is that Taylor didn't really care about winning Survivor. He was there to have some fun for the jokes and for Figgy. And you know, he clearly, you might have made a mistake if a guy is saying he is playing to avenge Figgy. Mm-hmm. You know, 2 weeks later, if his main goal, it's like a Jeff Kent situation where his main goal is to get Penner out. You know, there, something has gone wrong if your adversary's main goal is just against you.
Right, right. It's made a miscalculation. And also, I think that that might end up changing whether or not Michaela goes home, because I think that part of why Michaela went home was her making mm-hmm. such a big fuss over, you know, by Felicia, and, you know, that I'm so happy she's gone, that Jay's right. like, I don't know. So maybe Jay feels more comfortable about knocking out a Gen Xer in that spot. But again, now we're really, you know, going down the fan fiction rabbit hole. Amanda Rabinowitz has a question for you, Spencer. Will Jeff have to give Will a letter during the finale apologizing for constantly making fun of how young he is?
He should, but I don't think he will. I don't know. I feel bad for Will. Jeff has really like taken every opportunity, but I don't know. I have a feeling Jeff's sympathies are not toward Will, and I think he's going to be a little distracted playing Jerry Springer with Figgy and Tails.
Yeah, and Sophie was so hard on Will last night.
Yeah, I didn't catch all of her know-it-alls. I caught the beginning, but what did she say?
Oh, she said she doesn't like him and she doesn't even know why. She can't put her finger on it.
It must be the America boxers.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, it's. We just came off of a tribe name being Murica. I don't know. It's crazy times. Who knows what makes anyone not like Will?
Okay. Grant has a question. Wants to know, do you think that seasons with an exceptionally large jury, as was the case in Cambodia, leads to groupthink among the jury? How do you think that Michelle and Taylor being early jurors will impact the overall mentality and values of it? Do you think that a 10-person jury is too big? Because going back to Cagayan, you were part of, was it an 8-person jury?
Eight-person
jury in a final two. Then right. you played in Cambodia.
Sorry, it was a 9-person jury.
Sorry, 9-person okay. jury. And then we had a 10-person jury with a final three. In Cambodia.
Right. Yeah, see, the sample size is one as far as the 13 people in the merge. So I got a reserve judgment there. Although, I mean, I think Samoa had a big jury. They had 9 and also, you know, kind of a group think. But I think you can't really read too much into that, the size of the jury. I do think it's so important who the first few jurors are. And so I think it's really tough for Adam right now that the first jurors are Michelle, Taylor, maybe Jay.
Is it tough because they sort of just like beat the drum? Like, do you think that the people that go out around the merge have a good sense of what actually was happening in the game, where they're like going out around like halfway through and then the other half they're at mm-hmm. Ponderosa?
I do think they, you know, get information and sort of do get a pretty clear picture. But I think the bigger thing is, you know, if you talk to people are not always, it depends on the group they're with as far as how honest they'll be about what they think. And I think you become what you pretend to be. So if you're in a situation where you kind of go along with people and pretend to think what they think, you start to think it a little bit. And so I do think it's very powerful. Let's say Will is the next juror. Let's say all three of those jurors hate Adam. And then let's say Ken is the fourth juror. Ken might not have anything against Adam, but he's not going to voice that probably. We're social creatures. He's not about to get out of a game where he's very vulnerable. He's been starving. He's ready to just connect with people, decompress. He's not ready for a conflict over, you know, who he likes in the game. And so I think the groupthink as far as the people who start at Ponderosa does matter.
Chris Hickey wants to know, do you see a Gen X jury possibly voting for a millennial winner? Just thought it might be interesting to compare it to your situation in Cambodia. So older people on a jury mm-hmm. that there was a lot of talk about, you know, and, you know, everybody loved Jeremy that was on the jury. But for the people that are sort of the older players on the jury, like, what would it take for them to say, hey, young person, you beat me, you got my jury vote.
Right. Honestly, like the more I watch Survivor and having played twice, I think that the biggest factor as far as who people vote for is who they like.
Yeah.
I really think as much as you say it's about gameplay or about who deserves the money, I think the biggest thing is who they like. And I think if the person that people like the most is the person who played really strategically, then their criteria becomes, I'm going to vote for the best player. And if the person that they like is not as strategic, then their criteria becomes, well, he deserves it.
Had a bad, or the other person had a bad social game.
Right. And it can be a mix of both. I think, you know, like Jeremy, for instance, many people saw him playing the best game. Many people saw him being the best guy, deserving the money the most. He, you know, really like had a lot of things working for him. But I think the single biggest factor is who do people like the most. And so I do think there is definitely a shot for a millennial to win with a Gen X jury. I think they just have to be liked, and maybe they won't be seen as having played the same game that an older person who went down the same path would have been seen as. But I think a different rationale could easily develop where the people would vote for who they like and they could win.
Yeah, it really do. I agree 100% in terms of what you're saying about the social game. And that's really the thing that, as I've continued to do this podcast for many years, it's just like social game is the most mm-hmm. important thing. And I probably would have said it was the least important thing in terms of maybe when I first started the podcast.
Right. Like your winner pick, Survivor Nicaragua, is Marty Piombo.
Yes.
And but yeah, you go through, you know, Survivor history, and you I think, you know, a lot of the observations you've made ring so true. The emotional argument carries more weight. The people who ingratiate themselves socially have more sway. And ultimately, in terms of the winner, the social game and the likability, I think, win the day.
Okay. This is a question from Ryan Springer. As a fellow Chicago chess player, how has chess been going for you? It looks like you don't play rated games anymore. Do you still play a lot, or have you improved?
He did his research. Yeah, I have been out of tournament play for a bit. I'm so busy right now with working with... I'm trying to close on a property with a friend that we are trying to buy in Chicago on the South Side. And this podcast is, you know, a big passion. A lot's going into that. So I'm finding less and less time for the chess these days.
Are you less interested in it, or it's just a matter of time?
I think it's a matter of priorities. I don't really believe in saying in time, because there are an infinite number of things that one could do. So I think it's really priorities. And so, yeah, it's not that the interest has fallen. It's more that the interest for other things has risen.
Yeah. In the podcast that you did, you were talking about why you started to take up things like puzzles at a young age, and it was just something that you mm-hmm. felt like that you could control.
Yeah.
And as you are feeling better and, you know, dealing with, you know, at being less depressed at times, is that a factor in terms of like you don't want to play, or you don't make the time to play chess anymore because you don't need it as a therapy?
Yeah, that's really interesting that you say that. I've never thought about it that way, but I think it's really plausible. Like I've heard interviews of people who had troubled childhoods and tumultuous childhoods, and they say, you know, books were their escape. So I think chess probably was that for me, and analysis was that for me. And so, yeah, Rob, I mean, I think as far as making progress, a big thing for me has been getting in touch with like my internal beliefs, my core beliefs. And it's easy to believe something rationally or cognitively in your prefrontal cortex, but what is in the limbic system is really, I think, carries a lot more weight in terms of dictating your life, what you believe emotionally. And people believe some ridiculous things emotionally. Like you might, you know, tell people on the street or tell your friends and family, yeah, like I think I'm a good guy. I'm doing my best. I've got these interests. I've got a good job, blah, blah, blah. This is what's important to me. And that just might not be what you emotionally believe at all. And so bridging the gap between those two belief systems and getting in touch with the emotional beliefs and addressing them, I've noticed a lot of progress from doing that. And I do think I feel a lot more safe now being vulnerable, being genuine, authentic. So that's a long-winded way of answering your question with maybe.
Maybe. Jen Manning wants to know, can you tell us a little bit about your experience at Durham Warrior Survival Challenge? Yeah. It was great to meet you there. So we saw you in July in Chicago at the RahabCon, mm-hmm. and then you went to go play in the Durham Challenge. That was after RahabCon?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay.
It was.
So tell people what that is for the uninitiated.
So Durham Warriors is this event in Maine. It's like a mock survivor game that takes place over 3 days. And it's put on by Bob Crowley. He's got a ton of land, all these yurts in Maine. And it's like Survivor without the TV and without actually going through all that stuff for an extended period of time. You know, it's only 3 days. So it was a blast. It was fun to play Survivor without, you know, like necessarily the pressure of anything and without having to derail my life. Cause I think, and you probably feel this way too, like that's a big reason why Survivor, as awesome as it is, loses some appeal, as it takes your life completely off track for mm-hmm. a decent amount of time. So Durham Warriors was awesome in that sense. And I would encourage anyone who likes Survivor to look into it.
How did you get involved with that?
So I talked to Andy Baker, reached mm-hmm. out to me yes. about Durham Warriors and said, you know, it was a good opportunity to play Survivor. Could be a lot of fun. That, you know, also former Survivor players that I love, that I would love the chance to meet, talk to, frequently go, and it's a good community that's built up around it. So I thought, you know, it's definitely worth checking out. And, you know, I thought, you know, worst case scenario, I get voted out first and pick Richard Hatch's brain for a little while.
Did he play?
He didn't play. No, okay. he just hung out. And Kathy Sleckman, who is awesome to meet. Kathy's a riot. Actually, like one of my favorite people from it was Twyla.
Yes.
I played on a tribe with Twyla and Wendy, who asked this question. And Twyla was just awesome to get to know. Really cool.
Yeah. Okay. How did you place?
I got fourth place.
Fourth place. Oh, you're right. Yeah, you're right there.
Kageyan all over again, man.
Yeah, you're right there. And what happened? You didn't win the last challenge?
I won 4 challenges in a row and then lost the final immunity challenge.
Yeah.
That's my fate, Rob.
Bummer. Yeah. A lot of people asked questions about the new Gilmore Girls and what your reaction is to this.
I can't wait.
Yeah.
It's going to be so good. There's a trailer out that's awesome. I'm really excited for it. I think it's going to be like, people were excited about the Full House coming back.
Yes.
I think this is going to be that times 10.
Yeah. Wow. Apparently there's only 7 more days until the release. That's what Caitlin Kupski says.
It's on the 25th.
Yes.
Which is Marcella and I's anniversary. So we will be celebrating by watching a lot of Gilmore Girls.
She's into it too? Or did she get you into it? Or you got her into it?
I got her into it. We genuinely are like a reversal of the gender stereotypes as far as movie preferences and TV. Mm-hmm. I got her into Gilmore Girls. She's always dragging me to watch like stupid action movies and like the Avengers.
Avengers of Figgy? Like,
the event. I don't know if we're going to make it out to see that picture in particular. But Avengers Age of Ultron, we were all over it. That's really her jam. But I did introduce her to Gilmore Girls. She hasn't really been as big a fan of the Westworld, though, unfortunately.
Unfortunately. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's always time.
Yeah, I don't think that one's going to happen. But there's a lot of Stars Hollow in our viewing future.
Okay. This is a question from Golden from New Zealand wants to know, is this season's individual immunity idol the most phallic idol of all time? Did someone in production look at all the men left in the game at the merge and add a couple of white shells to the immunity idol at the last minute? Have you noticed this? This was not a thing I noticed.
I did not notice this. It actually fits with like the broader narrative of what's happening though. Cause I think like someone got in the editing room and is really like changing course on some things. Like Shireen pointed something out to me the other day, which is for everyone listening, pause your, not the last three episodes because he's been invisible, but if you go back, pause the screen during one of Ken's confessionals. 70% of the time, if you look at the pose he's in, he's like, it's as if he's leaning back against a tree, but there's no tree. And it's like, I don't know how they got him to be in this position, but it's like, they're like, all right, Ken, now lean back as if you're leaning against something. All right, now pretend like you're doing a crunch. Now just hold. And sure enough, like every one of his confessionals, it's just like 8-pack. And he's like doing a crunch in the air.
Wow. Is that how you get an 8-pack? You're just doing crunches in the air all the time?
Do enough confessionals. And usually people go on Survivor to lose weight. I think people should go on Survivor to bulk.
Is that the Survivor workout of just like like confessionals and crunches all the time?
For Ken, I don't know how they've even like convinced him to be in these positions. But if you like watch his confessionals, he's not comfortable. Like, okay. Look at the position. I'm Googling right now to see this immunity necklace.
Let me see if I could find a picture of it. I don't know where the best way to see the new immunity necklace. Maybe it's in the photos on CBS.com. I feel like that somebody maybe also tweeted a picture of it, and I got what they were saying in terms of the picture, but I'd like to at least give it another look and maybe show it to you.
Well, good, Rob. Like, if they're going to take our poles away in the challenge and make them balance balls on bows, at least give us this, right?
Yeah. So we'll see if we can find a picture of that and get your take on it. And then I have one more question for you. David Baltazar wants to know, since Jeff is offering his services, would you let Jeff officiate your wedding, Spencer?
It's going to become like the Jeff versus Stephen Fishbach dilemma in the Survivor community.
Yes. Which ordained minister do you want?
Stephen would be a nice redemption story after the red wedding of RHAP.
Is that what it's called?
That's what you called it. But I would let Jeff marry me.
Yeah. Wow. That'd be something.
As long as he did like a play by play, if he like not too much of the talking and officiating, but like just sort of let the ceremony take course and did like play by play live action narration. That's what I would want.
Yeah. So you want him like as the ceremony is going on, like Spencer is now.
Well, I wouldn't really
getting
be the,
walked
the,
down the aisle.
I wouldn't really have the agency. It would be more, you know, the woman. I would be like, Spencer, still standing there, just waiting. Will it be a runaway bride? Will it not? I don't know. Spencer, things seem to mess up with it for him at the last moment. Will it go through?
And then it happens.
Yeah, then it happens. That would be a good wedding.
It would be a fantastic wedding. But that's, nothing imminent on that front, right?
Well, actually, Rob, I do want to make an announcement exclusive to RHAP.
No, stop.
correct. Nothing
you're
imminent
gonna
on
fake
that,
it. You're going to fake everybody out. Such a prankster. You're like Tony.
Oh God, yeah. So I am having a sleepover with my friend right now.
Yes. Any fireside chats of late?
Man, not enough. I need to text Tony like right now, actually. It's been a while since I've talked to him. He's doing pretty well, I think. He's just, focusing on the family and stuff. He's got a good life and I think he's got a good thing going, so I'm happy for him and I'm going to check in.
Okay. Here, let me see if I can show you this picture. And somebody, this is at Henshin Kitty, has sort of like done like a Microsoft Paint job on this.
Oh my God.
Also, and sort of like outlined what they're talking about. I don't know. I think it's a stretch.
It's they're blue too.
I don't know. We'll see.
It's like
we'll
watch Blue Balls Immunity Idol.
Yeah, we'll watch for it next week to see ultimately how it ends up playing out if that becomes the thing. All right, Spencer, what's the hashtag today?
The hashtag, man. I always want to think about this during the podcast, and always have to think about it.
Is
after.
It hashtag John Snowboard?
It's mean, but yeah, I think that's the way to go. Bro, I know you need the money. See, he no longer needs the money for his snowboarding, like Jay said. He's like, bro, I know you need the money for for your snowboarding. He needs the money for John's snowboard.
For John's snowboard. Boy, that would be incredible if that ultimately did work out. So, all right, Spencer, how could people check out the new podcast that you're doing?
Yeah, so go to my Twitter. My pinned tweet will send you a link. We'll have a link to the iTunes page for the podcast. You could also probably search it on iTunes, but I mean, you can ignore all my stupid other tweets. I would really appreciate it if you went to my Twitter and shared that, retweeted that pinned tweet, or just went on, checked out the podcast, left a review. I am so excited about more and more people talking about this, getting involved with this. It's truly is like a passion for me.
Yeah.
So yeah, I would totally appreciate that. Anyone who's listening.
Look, it's a good cause and I'm sure it's something that's going to help people. So
you just retweeted it.
Yeah. Right? I like to do what I can to, you know, help people out, doing good stuff. So, that's really cool that you're doing this. And I think that, you know, that there are a lot of people out there that are in, going through stuff and feeling like that they're going through it alone. So I think it's a really amazing thing that you're trying to do.
Oh, thanks, Rob. I really appreciate their support.
Yeah. And I like to look at what else you're tweeting about on Twitter. So
I haven't been on my game lately, honestly. I went on a hiatus.
Yeah. You did tweet last night that I too just buy Marcella a sailboat whenever I'm unable to avenge her.
Marcella just got home, actually. She likes that one.
Yes. You also were dealing with a very every man problem. Anyone who complains about lines at nightclubs has clearly never tried to book a dermatologist appointment.
It's true. Oh my God. Or a psychiatrist appointment.
That's tough to
do.
To
be more relevant, but yes. Yeah, it's months. I want to know the equivalent of however, you know, like you can go to the front of the line if you're like starring
VIP.
I need the VIP for the medical industry.
See, I don't know anything about booking dermatologist appointments or being in lines at nightclubs. So this is just like completely like unrelatable to me.
Yeah, that means you live a happy life with no lines.
No lines. Yeah, I have to leave my house. Dream. Yeah. You said, if I spent as much time optimizing myself as I spent optimizing my Elder Scrolls video game characters, I'd be really awesome. Yes. What are Elder Scrolls video game characters?
Oh, you don't know the Elder Scrolls?
I'm a Gen Xer.
Oh yeah, that's true. You, the letter U, are a Gen Xer. But it's basically these RPGs that it's like kind of Game of Thrones-esque in that it's Middle Earth and there's magic, and in the most recent game, Skyrim, there are dragons, and there's a huge lore to the games, and it's a huge open world game that I put in, I think Elder Scrolls 4 Oblivion, I put in 400 hours to playing. So it's a very important thing in the world.
And just that I'm noticing, and then you tweeted a couple times about Survivor in the last couple of days, and then you tweeted in like July and March, mm-hmm, and that's mm-hmm. it. And this is the crazy thing. Cass, same thing. Cass is like barely, you know, has like five tweets this year in terms of, like, if you go look at like her page. Tony like deleted his Twitter. And just to think, there was a point where you guys are all so prolific. It's like Woo has become the most dynamic Final Four Kageyan tweeter.
Yeah, he's... Yeah, well, Wu is also a commercial star now.
Yes, yes. I saw Wu a couple of weeks ago at the... I went to the EW Pop Fest.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I saw that. And Jeff was there. But no, it's weird. Like, Tony, Cass, and I are, like, strangely, a little disturbingly in sync with the Twitter.
Yeah, you guys
like,
are remember, all on the same page. And, Wu is the most active.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wu's killing it. He's... I'm just looking at him now. People don't need to hear about me watching, looking at people's Twitters.
Yeah. No, and Wu, he was like Brett at the challenge. There was like an open bar there. And I was like, Wu, what are you doing? Like, you got to stop the, you know, having these drinks. Like, we're supposed to be doing challenges. I was like afraid that I was going to like have a couple of drinks and then like Rob's passed out on the floor, falling down drunk.
Wu did seem really loose. I saw like one of the clips from that and he was like, what's up, Jeff? It was like a spring break video with him and Probst.
Yeah. Well, even him and Abby Maria were getting along. So you knew that it was, you know, everybody was having a fun day.
Yeah, that's a good sign for sure.
She wasn't even mad that he wrote her name down two times.
Was it two times?
I think it was two times. Yeah. So everybody was in a good mood. All right. Well, Spencer, great stuff. At Spencer BGM is the Twitter. Always a pleasure to get to talk to you. I know that the listeners always love to hear from you too. So thanks again for coming back with us, and all the best with the new venture.
Thanks. Thanks a ton, Rob. I had a blast.
All right, everybody. There you have it. The young lad, Spencer Bledsoe, back here on the podcast. Always fun to check in with Spencer and see what he's doing. And really cool that he is starting out the new podcast and is doing something that hopefully is going to help a lot of people that are out there. All right. So here's what's coming up next. We have our Survivor voicemail podcast coming up with Megan Z. I think it should be a very fun show, talking about all of your feedback on this episode coming up next. And then, of course, we will get back into the BBOTT coming up on Friday. So looking forward to all that. Got another fun bonus podcast for you guys coming up over the weekend, where I am going to be talking about, we've talked about this for a long time coming, about what would a season of Big Brother look like if we were going to play it out completely with the cast of Seinfeld. That's going to be coming up to celebrate 7 seasons in the books of our Seinfeld post-show recap with Akiva Whitaker. So be on the lookout for that over the weekend. And then we'll get into everything with the Wiggle Room. And of course, why Taylor lost. Why Taylor lost might be a 5-hour podcast, by the way, with David Bloomberg. And then next week, we have our Thanksgiving double episode. Stephen Bishback will be back on the Know-It-Alls. Plus, we'll get into everything with Tyson on the voicemail and the recap coming up next week. So a very, very busy week of podcasting as we get through the end of November here on Rob is a Podcast. Of course, none of this would be possible without the great patrons of Rob is a Podcast. To find out more about the benefits of becoming a patron and everything that comes along with that, you can go to our Patreon profile page at robisawebsite.com/patron, or click the banner on robisawebsite.com to watch our behind the scenes video of what goes on and what goes into the making of Rob is a Podcast. Looking forward to hearing what you have to say in the comments, and we'll talk to you soon. Thanks so much to Scott St. Pierre for the editing of this episode of Rob is a Podcast. Take care. Bye.